From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! As ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya flew over the airport, Honduran military blocked the runway to prevent him from landing. Tens of thousands of Zelaya supporters converged on the airport to welcome him back. The military opened fire, killing at least two people. We'll go to Tegucigalpa to speak with Andres Contreras, who was at the scene. Then renowned investigative journalist and filmmaker John Pilger on Honduras, Iran, the media, President Obama, and resistance.
All those groups that are allied with the Democratic Party have got a lot of work to do if there is going to be any change whatsoever in Washington. And I think people are so hypnotized, so mesmerized, and almost in love with the idea of Obama that that is yet to happen. That's a shame.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 1 week after the military coup that overthrew him, Honduran President Manuel Zelaya was prevented from returning to Honduras Sunday after the coup government refused to allow his entry. Honduran military forces blocked runways at Honduras's main airport, forcing Zelaya's plane to turn around and eventually go on to El Salvador. Heavily armed Honduran soldiers used tear gas and machine guns to disperse an unarmed crowd of tens of thousands of people who had come to greet Zelaya. At least two people were reportedly killed and many others wounded. We'll have more on Honduras after headlines. President Obama's in Russia today for talks on a new treaty to reduce U.S. and Russian stockpiles of nuclear weapons. Negotiators have agreed to a modest weapons cut, but remain in a standstill over the fate of the proposed U.S. missile system in Eastern Europe. The Obama administration's refused to renounce the Bush administration-backed system, even though it's widely seen as ineffective in its stated purpose of missile defense and actually intended as a first-strike weapon against Iran. The U.S. is also rejecting Russian calls for a sharp reduction in the numbers of long-range missile launchers and heavy bombers under a new treaty. Obama, meanwhile, has won an agreement to let military flights bound for Afghanistan fly over Russian territory. In China, at least 140 people have been killed and more than 800 wounded in the western Xinjiang region. On Sunday, hundreds of protesters clashed with police at a rally demanding justice for the killing of two Uyghur workers at southern Chinese factory last month. The Chinese government says a group of exiled Uyghurs caused the unrest, but protesters accused the police of cracking down on a peaceful gathering. Here in the United States, the Washington Post is reporting the nation's healthcare industry has hired more than 350 former government officials and members of Congress to sway healthcare reform efforts on Capitol Hill. According to lobbying records, three out of every four major healthcare companies have at least one former government insider on the payroll. Nearly half held positions under key committees and lawmakers, including Senators Max Baucus and Charles Grassley. Baucus is chair of the Senate Finance Committee, which is largely steering healthcare reform efforts. Baucus's aides recently held a meeting with a group of lobbyists that included two of his former chiefs of staff. The Washington Post says the healthcare industry is now spending $1.4 million a day on lobbying, totaling $126 million in the first fiscal quarter. A bankruptcy judge has cleared the way for the sale of the auto giant General Motors. Bondholders, unions, or consumer groups could still appeal the ruling before it takes effect later this week. New figures show the unemployment rate has reached a 26-year high of 9.5%. The U.S. lost 467,000 jobs last month, the first time monthly losses rose since a peak of 741,000 in January. In media news, The Washington Post has canceled and apologized for a planned event series that would have brought together lobbyists, government officials, corporate sponsors, and its own journalists. The so-called salons were to be held at the home of Washington Post publisher Catherine Weymouth. They were disclosed after the website Politico.com published details of a promotional flyer offering corporate sponsorships ranging from $25,000 to $250,000. The first dinner was scheduled to focus on healthcare. The Washington Post says it might still hold the events in the future, but maintains any discussions there would be on the record and not private, as the flyer claimed. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin has announced she'll step down later this month. On Friday, Palin said she wants to avoid becoming a lame duck governor after deciding not to seek re-election.
I promised efficiencies and effectiveness. That's not how I'm wired. I'm not wired to operate under the same old politics as usual. I promised that 4 years ago, and I meant it. That's not what is best for Alaska at this time. I'm determined to take the right path for Alaska, even though it is unconventional and it's not so comfortable.
Palin ran as Senator John McCain's vice presidential nominee in last year's elections and is considered a top Republican hopeful in 2012. Her replacement, Alaska Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell, says he thinks Palin's mounting legal bills over a series of ethics complaints forced her to step down. Palin's legal team, meanwhile, has warned news outlets not to publish stories speculating whether she's under federal investigation. The FBI says she's not under investigation. In a four-page letter, Palin's attorney warns that media groups could be sued if they grant space to rumors that Palin's being investigated for alleged embezzlement in the construction of a sports arena. Vice President Joe Biden has said the U.S. wouldn't prevent Israel from attacking Iran if the Israeli government decides it's an existential threat. Biden made the comment during an interview with ABC News host George Stephanopoulos.
If the Netanyahu government decides to take a course of action different than the one being pursued now, that is their sovereign right to do that. That is not our choice.
But just to be clear here, if the Israelis decide Iran is an existential threat, they have to take out the nuclear program militarily, the United States will not stand in the way?
Look, we cannot dictate to another sovereign nation what they can and cannot do when they make a determination, if they make a determination, that they're existentially threatened, their survival is threatened by another country.
You say we can't dictate, but we can, if we choose to deny overflight rights here in Iraq. There are ways we can stand in the way of a military strike.
I'm not going to speculate, George, on those issues, other than to say Israel has a right to determine what's in its interest, and we have a right and we will determine what's in our interest.
Biden spoke during a visit to Iraq, where on Friday he was greeted by hundreds of Iraqi protesters in Baghdad calling for an end to the U.S. occupation. A group of around 100 U.S. peace activists have arrived in Egypt, hoping to bring aid to the Gaza Strip. The activists are part of the group Viva Palestina, which conducted another aid mission from Europe earlier this year. Their arrival in Egypt comes as Israel is set to deport today a group of foreign activists kidnapped in international waters last week as they tried to reach Gaza. The Free Gaza delegation included former congressmember and presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney and the Irish peace activist and Nobel laureate Mairead Maguire. Both McKinney and Maguire are among those expected to be deported today. In Pakistan, at least 10 people were killed Friday in the latest U.S. drone attack. The bombing hit alleged militant hideouts in Pakistan's South Waziristan region near the Afghan border. A Pakistani attorney, meanwhile, has filed a legal challenge seeking to have the drone attacks prosecuted under international law. The attorney, M. Tariq Assad, filed the petition to Pakistan's Supreme Court last week. Assad wants the Pakistani government to submit a complaint to the World Court on the drone attacks killing of hundreds of people in Pakistan. The former Guantanamo prisoner Binyam Mohammed has filed a legal challenge seeking to prevent the destruction of evidence he says proved he was tortured in U.S. custody. Mohammed says the government is facing a pending deadline to destroy an image taken of him shortly after he was beaten by several guards. The image is to be destroyed since Mohammed is no longer jailed, but Mohammed says he needs it towards his lawsuit against the U.S. for unlawful incarceration. And in Afghanistan, two U.S. soldiers were killed this weekend during an operation in the Paktika province. It's the same area where a U.S. soldier disappeared last week and is now believed to have been captured by militants. The U.S. has meanwhile expanded its major attack in the southern Afghan province of Helmand, site of the largest marine offensive since the Vietnam War. Over the weekend, U.S. forces seized several key districts near the Afghan border with Pakistan. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A week after a military coup in Honduras, soldiers and riot police blocked the airport runway Sunday evening, preventing ousted President Manuel Zelaya from returning to the country. Heavily armed Honduran soldiers also used tear gas and machine guns to disperse an unarmed crowd of over, tens of thousands of people who come from all over the country despite military blockades to wait at the airport and welcome back their ousted president. At least two people were reportedly killed and more wounded. After several failed attempts to touch down at the Tegucigalpa airport, Zelaya's plane eventually flew to Nicaragua, where he met President Daniel Ortega. He was accompanied by the president of the UN General Assembly, Miguel Descoto Brockman, on the plane. Zelaya then went on to El Salvador, where he's due to meet the presidents of Argentina, Ecuador, Paraguay, and the head of the Organization of American States. On Saturday, the OAS suspended Honduras. It marked the organization's first suspension of a country in over 45 years. For more from Honduras, we're joined on the phone from Tegucigalpa by Andres Contreras. He is the program on the Americas Director for Nonviolence International. He worked as a human rights advocate in Honduras from 1994 to 1999. He is co-producer of Hidden in Plain Sight, a documentary film about U.S. policy in Latin America and the School of the Americas. And he works with Democracy Now! In Espanol. Andres, welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us what happened. You were at the airport?
Yes, I was at the airport, Amy, and it was a day of mostly peaceful demonstrations. The estimates on the numbers were well over 100,000 people in the streets of Tegucigalpa going to the airport. The police would block the marchers, but then every half hour or so they would retreat and therefore causing a pause in the march, but creating a sense of peace on both sides. So most of the day was very, very coordinated, and there was no problems. The violence erupted later in the afternoon, and it's very clear that a sharpshooter was the one responsible for killing one of the protesters near the airport entrance.
So tell us throughout the weekend how things went down and when what happened when President Zelaya, the ousted president, was flying over the airport.
Throughout the weekend, things have been getting more and more intense because, first, the expected arrival of President Zelaya was last Thursday. He himself announced that. And then the OAS said they needed some time to give Honduras a chance to return to constitutional order and return him to power. That was so the OAS gave Honduras the regime here 3 days. Then Mel Zelaya said he would come on Saturday, and then that was postponed until yesterday, Sunday. Throughout this time, the repression in the country has become more and more intensified. People from around the country have been trying to get to the capital to show their support for their president, and dozens of buses have been prevented from coming into the capital. One of the buses was machine-gunned on its tires, and Father Andres Tamayo from Olancho was beaten along with others while trying to come to the capital. This, along with the fear and intimidation tactics that are used against human rights leaders and especially members of the press that are trying to get the word out about those in the country who are against the coup.
Andres, what exactly is happening with the media in Honduras right now?
The media overwhelmingly in this country is controlled by an oligarchy that is very supportive of this coup. And so they are only trying to get out the story about some of the demonstrations that have been in favor of Roberto Micheletti taking power a week ago yesterday. However, the press, who is trying to give a balanced approach and to give voice to those who were in the streets yesterday and the recent days in addition to yesterday, they are finding they're facing incredible repression. There was a journalist on Friday who was murdered after leaving Radio America in San Juan Pueblo, in the rural area in the north. Then there are two journalists who are in hiding. One of them is the head of Channel 36. The other is the director of Radio Globo. Other journalists who have decided to continue their programming are facing death threats and fear and intimidation tactics. One journalist jumped three stories when the soldiers came to get him in Radio Globo on the day of the coup. And the reason he did is because he had been tortured in the 80s, and he feared that this would happen once again. He fractured his shoulder and has lesions around his body. Another journalist has had his family threatened, and just 2 days ago, his two sons on the street were threatened with a revolver by a car with darkened windows.
Also, a bomb July 4th, Saturday, exploded at Channel 11 in Tegucigalpa.
That happened at 9:30 p.m. at night, and it was the first bomb that had been placed at any institution that actually went off. The material damage was severe. There was no one else hurt. But Channel 11 has not been known as a channel that would give the side that is counter to this regime that is in power now, but they were attempting to do some small efforts to give a balanced approach. But even in doing that, that is what caused them to be a target of this bombing. The other channels closed. I said Channel 36, also Channel 45. In terms of radios, Radio Globo in Tegucigalpa is the station that has most been under attack. I mentioned the man who jumped three stories. The director is in hiding. Other journalists are under life threat. One of the radio stations in the countryside, Radio Progreso, this was shut down. Radio Progreso is a very, very progressive voice run by the Jesuit community. One station here in Tegucigalpa that carries the headline news for Democracy Now! was clearly forced to take headline news of Democracy Now! Off of the air because we have been reporting on the coup. So the press censorship has been very, very severe, and the intimidation and terror tactics against journalists have been incrementing.
Can you talk about the curfew, the sunset to sunrise curfew that has been imposed? And also, BBC reported that as President Zelaya, the ousted president, wasn't able to land, his supporters at the airport began shouting, "We want blue helmets," meaning UN peacekeepers.
Yes, the curfew was first imposed very soon after the night of the coup. In fact, the coup happened very early in the morning a week ago Sunday on the 28th of June, and the curfew was imposed that night from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m. That was put in place for the next few days, and then the Congress passed a law that extended the curfew, but not only that, limited guaranteed constitutional rights of freedom of gathering, freedom of association, and freedom to protect their very rights. In other words, once the curfew is in force, which was 9 p.m., but that yesterday was changed to 6:30 p.m. until 5 a.m. in the morning. During that time, any house can be raided, and all the constitutional guarantees of the citizens here are canceled. The international press has also received harassment if they are trying to report an anti-coup position, and have been threatened with leaving the country, especially journalists from Telesur and others from Venezuela.
Andres, very quickly, because we just have a minute, can you talk about the situation of the United States not calling it a coup in Honduras and the very close U.S. relationship with Honduras, particularly the aid that has not been cut off, though military cooperation the Obama administration has announced has been cut off?
The U.S. policy toward Honduras historically has been one of having a great deal of control, and the U.S. policy continues to be that. It's very clear that the U.S. is trying to associate itself with not only Latin America but the entire world. But even though the United States is not following even U.S. law, which says that no aid, either economic or military, can go to a country when it is declared that a coup has happened. Both Obama and Hillary Clinton have said a coup has happened, but they have not legally declared that the case. That means that aid continues to flow, even though the State Department has used the word that there has been a pause, and even though the Pentagon has said that associations between the U.S. military and Honduran military have been minimized. Even those symbolic efforts, even if they have happened, it doesn't mean that the aid should continue to flow, and therefore the U.S. is in violation of its own law in continuing to support this regime. The history of the U.S. in this country is also full of repression. The School of the Americas trained the coup leader here, the general who took over, and Billy Joya, also related to the Battalion 316, a death squad, which was founded during the time of John Dmitry Negroponte. Billy Joya is a key security advisor to the so-called President Roberto Micheletti. And so the ties of U.S. policy here continue to be damaging, and the U.S. is not taking an active role in resolving this crisis.
Andres Contreras, I want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Tegucigalpa. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, John Pilger, the award-winning filmmaker on Honduras, Iran, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and more. Stay with us. Sadie Sosa here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, from the events in Honduras, we step back to reflect on how the media has been covering the coup in that country. Last week, award-winning investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker John Pilger was visiting the United States. He was born in Australia but has lived in London since the 60s and began his career as a hard-hitting war reporter covering the Vietnam War. He's written close to a dozen books and made over 50 documentaries on subjects ranging from struggles around the world for a more just and peaceful society and against Western military and economic intervention, films on East Timor, Cambodia, Vietnam, Iraq, Israel, Palestine, and the United States. Well, last week, I had a wide-ranging conversation with John Pilger on Honduras, Iran, Gaza, the media, healthcare, and Obama's wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I began by asking John Pilger to comment on the current state of the mainstream media and how it shapes our perceptions and priorities.
I don't believe anything has changed. And if it is going to change, if in the Middle East, as in other parts of the world, I think one of the really significant and building areas of discussion, and indeed it's been building for the last few years, is just the kind of information we get through the so-called mainstream. We have many alternative sources of information now, not least of all your own program, though I wouldn't call that alternative. But for most people, the primary source of their information is the mainstream. It is mainly television, even the internet. For all its subversiveness, has still a very large component of the mainstream, and that means that we're getting still this either it's a singular message about wars, about the economy, about all those things that touch our lives. Or we're getting what I would call a kind of contrived silence, a censorship by omission. I think this is almost the principal issue of today, because without information, we can't possibly begin to influence governments. We can't possibly begin to end the wars. All of this, it seems to me, has come together in the presidency of Barack Obama, who is almost a creation of this media world. He promised some things, although most of them were amorphous, and has delivered virtually the opposite. He's started his own war in Pakistan. We see the events in Iran and Honduras being quite subtly but very directly influenced in the time-honored way by the Obama administration. And yet the Obama administration is still given this extraordinary benefit of the doubt by people who, in my view, are influenced by mainstream media. It's a time when I think we're either going to begin to understand how the media really works, or we're going to let that opportunity pass. It's almost an historic opportunity that we understand that the perception of our world is utterly distorted most of the time through what are seen as credible sources of information.
John, talk about the contrast between the media coverage of the Iranian elections and the Honduran coup and the response to it on the ground.
Well, you take the New York Times. The New York Times basically has said that, in so many words, that the Iranian protests represent a mass movement embracing the majority in that country. Now, there's no doubt that among the people protesting, the many people protesting in the streets of Iran are those who want another Iran, those who want greater freedoms. We've heard from them in the past. But without any smoking gun, without any credible information, without any evidence that election in Iran was rigged, to get rid of something like 10 million votes. I mean, I don't think anyone doubts that in an election like Iran's, like an election in the United States, there is fraud. In most elections there are. And there may well have been extensive fraud in the Iranian election. But the way our perception of those events in Iran has been manipulated is to suggest that this was a great a revolution that was set to overthrow the Islamic Revolution of 1979. That's just simply not true. That has preoccupied the mainstream media, has been on the front pages and top of the news and the networks. Contrast that with Honduras. Yes, it has been a news item, but way at the end of Michael Jackson. And as a main component of this news item has been the Obama administration's alleged condemnation of the Honduran coup. But if you look at the condemnation, which is built on the fact that they said that they tried to dissuade the Honduran military from staging the coup, and I have to say Hillary Clinton doesn't want to call it a coup, because if she called it a coup, the Foreign Assistance Act would kick in, and she'd have to withdraw all the military support to the 600 U.S. military personnel who are based in Honduras. But she said, administration officials have said, look, we tried to persuade the Honduran military from going ahead with this. Well, it turned that around. Is that means that they knew that a coup was coming, and it just beggars belief that that they didn't play a major role in the events that may well have got out of their control. They may well have not wanted the coup in its present form, in its present crude form, to happen. But they knew about it. It so parallels the 2002 coup against Chavez. Now, that story, which is really is the kernel of that news story, it is really what matters in that news story. Did the U.S. play its traditional role or not? And why has the elected president of Honduras been kicked out of his country? That's been relegated. So you have two news stories. You have the Iranian story of protests for freedom. That's approved. That's a worthy story. You have the Honduras story of our friends in the South just getting a little bit out of control. That's an unworthy story. Two different perceptions in two very, very important areas.
I wanted to play for you a clip of David Gregory on NBC. He replaced Tim Russert as the moderator of Meet the Press. And he was interviewing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the midst of the crackdown on the protests in Iran.
Does the United States have a unique role to play here in continuing to support this freedom movement, as you call it, in Iran? An obligation to support the protesters, to really give them moral support at the very least?
I think it's clear that that the United States, the people of the United States, the president of the United States, free people everywhere, decent people everywhere, are amazed at the desire of the people there to, and their willingness to stand up for their rights. I cannot, as I said, tell you what is going to happen. I'll tell you what I would do. What we all would do in the face of demonstrations. As we speak, David, there's a demonstration right now outside my window, outside my office. Well, democracies act differently. They don't send armed agents of the regime to brutally mow down the demonstrators. I'll tell you what I did. I called in these demonstrators. They happened to be representatives of a non-Jewish minority in Israel, the Druze community. They have certain protests about the financing of their municipalities. I called their leaders in. Mm-hmm. I talked to them. I said, how can I help you? That's what democratic leaders do. That's what democratic countries do.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. David Gregory didn't ask him about, didn't push him on this point of how the Israeli military deals with protest. But what's your response to this, John Pilger?
But no one ever presses an Israeli leader, Netanyahu or any of them. None of them are protest. They're given, Israeli leaders were given a legitimacy during what was unconditionally a massacre in December, January of this year. And the sum of that was to suggest, number one, that there was a war between Israel and Gaza, and there wasn't. There was an assault on Gaza that was aimed at civilians, on a defenseless country, on a helpless country, a trapped people. And the second impression was that, yes, Israel is a democracy. We'll discuss this on television with you. We'll discuss the finer points. The way Israel is reported in the United States is media manipulation as almost a high art form. When people like Netanyahu, whose very utterances and whose background would suggest somebody, I think it's fair to say, not credible, but somebody those of us would say somebody who would be a prima facie war criminal, is given this kind of legitimacy, not even questioned, not even
challenged about the events in his country and his own extreme utterances. Yes, we have cartoon figures like Lieberman, his foreign minister, a very important but a rather grotesque character in a sense.
So Avigdor Lieberman.
He can be made perhaps he can be drawn out as the sort of the strange bad apple in that barrel. But I think it's that legitimacy that mainstream media gives one side, and the sum of that in as far as Palestine is concerned is that there is no illegitimate occupation. There is no illegality. There's some illegality, as Obama referred to in his Cairo speech, about the continuing building of settlements. But there is no suggestion that this is the longest, most brutal, illegal military occupation in our lifetime.
Let me just go to that for 1 minute. President Obama in Cairo giving his address in the Middle East, talking specifically about the settlements.
The United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements. This construction violates previous agreements and undermines efforts to achieve peace. It is time for these settlements to stop.
That was President Obama in Cairo in his heralded address to the Muslim world. John Pilger, he says the continued expansion of settlements has to stop. Your response, and then overall, to his entire address.
Well, he said the continuing response, but what about all the settlements, the so-called settlements, colonies, that have so honeycombed the occupied territories over a period of now almost several almost two decades? I thought the most significant aspect of that statement was that he referred to the continuing. They should stop the continuing settlements. So leave the ones that have already been built. Let's stop building them now. And of course, the Israelis, ever resourceful in this area, got round this very quickly by issuing building licenses to those settlements that were about to be built and hadn't been built, as if they had been built, so they wouldn't fall into President Obama's category. I didn't think that President Obama's Cairo speech added up to anything. It had different language. It didn't use Bush's aggressive, "You're with us or against us." It was very soothing. I read one commentator's rather apt description of Obama's words as supplying a kind of mood music to the Middle East. But in the end, what did he offer? Did he talk about the law? And the whole issue of Palestine is really about a respect for law. Did he go back to the 1976 resolution? There it is. It calls on a Palestine state. Did he reach out to the government in Gaza, which, in spite of the media distortion, has time and again called for a two-state agreement in the Middle East? Did he make any move that would begin to resolve this injustice? Did he paint it as an injustice? Because that's what it is. It's an injustice on a scale that none of us in our own countries, in our own lives, would tolerate. The answer is no, he didn't. Now, this is not to suggest that there will be some helpful window dressing here and there. I don't know. But it seems to me that the pressure on Obama over the Middle East, as indeed over so many other issues, has been so minimal that he can simply perform as Bush Light.
He did, however, I believe for the first time for a president, admit the U.S. is involved in the 1953 overthrow of a democratically elected leader, and that was in Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh.
Yeah, but gee, what a concession, Amy. We get 1953, 56 years ago. That's easy. That's easy. But it's what has happened since then. The demonizing of Iran goes on. The lecturing of Iran, which is an extremely politically complex society, goes on. And the policy is unchanged. The crime always is independence. Iran is an independent state and has almost miraculously maintained itself in forms that we might not approve of, certainly, but it has maintained itself as an independent major state in the Middle East. That is absolutely intolerable to the U.S. state. And Obama has not shifted from that at all. He's made a number of patronizing appeals to the Iranians, but now as he's in effect saying that the protesters should be allowed to control the streets of Tehran, turn that around. What if it was suggested that protesters should be allowed to control the streets of Washington? But that's, of course, another side of double standards. I don't believe anything has changed. And if it is going to change, if in the Middle East, as in other parts of the world, there has to be greater pressure from within the anti-war movement, within the peace movement, within all those groups that have allied themselves with the Democrats.
Renowned filmmaker John Pilger will continue with my interview with him in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we return to my interview with the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker John Pilger. John Pilger, you're not an American citizen, but I'd like you to comment on American politics. With the election of the certification of the election of Al Franken to be the 60th Democrat in the Senate, the Democrats have a supermajority. They can pass a filibuster-proof majority. They can pass anything they want. The question is, from foreign policy to domestic policy, what exactly President Obama will do with this? Primary on his domestic agenda is health care. You come from Britain, though born in Australia. What are your comments on how this debate is being carried out in the United States? More than 70% of Americans say they want a public plan. But it's pretty clear that even people within President Obama's own party are terrified, or at least getting millions of dollars from the health insurance and health care industry. Explain your system in Britain.
Amy, my impression gained over many years, and I don't think I'd call myself an honorary citizen, but I've certainly come to this country and lived in it for many years. My impression is that ordinary Americans are so far ahead of their politicians, so far ahead of their media, and so far ahead of all those who claim to be their betters and who bestow on them stereotypes that are almost contemptuous. Indeed, you can go back to Madison when he described the American public as at best meddlesome. I think if you look at the credible polls, say those done by the Pew Organization, then you will see that the majority of Americans are very dangerously subversive. I would say that they may even be left-wing. This is a very worrying situation, of course, but the majority of them want the decencies. As you've suggested, they want a universal healthcare system. Now, I'm talking about two-thirds here. I think the figures I saw were 74%. They want their country out of the colonial wars that they're fighting, the various wars, Afghanistan and Iraq. They want the government to take responsibility for those who cannot care for themselves. They want the banks and the banksters, as Franklin Roosevelt called them, are brought to account. They have decent, I hesitate to call them radical views. They're not radical views. They're just the views of decency. But they're views at huge odds with their government, be it a Bush government or an Obama government. And their views are at odds with the media that claim to represent them, to be their agents, as it were. And to watch this so-called debate, it's not a debate, Amy. It's a farce. What Obama is moving towards is what Hillary Clinton tried to before she allied herself with some of the worst elements in the health insurance business. What he's moving towards is a very messy version of the old system that will allow the old pirates still to run it, that certain insurance will be guaranteed, yes, on a Medicare basis, but it will be a mess.
Could you explain, because it's so unusual to hear about what other systems are without them just being described as socialist, and so you end the discussion.
Yeah.
Interestingly, single payer in the United States, most popular option, and yet it is almost never mentioned in the media except by those who attack it. Canada has a system that where the government pays for health care. In Britain, the doctors are employees of the state. Can you explain how the British medical system works, and if it works?
Well, I've lived in the UK most of my life, and I've used the National Health Service. I regard it as a treasure. I regard it as I've had some of the best care for not particularly serious ailments, but I've had some of the best care that I could possibly have. What happens is you go to a GP, a general practitioner, and you can choose which one you want to go to in your area. You sign nothing. They simply have your name and address. And you're seen by that doctor. If there's something that is required, you're referred to a specialist. Where I live in London, I'm surrounded by five of the world's major teaching hospitals, all of them run by the National Health Service. The the way the National Health Service is represented in the United States is truly scandalous. That word socialist is pulled out. It's kind of infantile almost. Yes, it's socialist. If socialist is caring for the majority of the people and taking away the fear of being denied health care that so many millions of Americans have, they have this fear, then yes, it is. It's a vast community operation that is highly imperfect. Especially, it doesn't provide enough care for the mentally ill. It doesn't provide enough care for the aged. In some parts of Britain, outside the major urban centres, it's not as good as it is if you, say, go to London and you're near a great teaching hospital, as I am. But it's bereft of the kind of bureaucracy that means tests anyone coming into it. I don't sign anything when I go into hospital. I do sign when the doctors want to do something to me. You have to sign a waiver, you know, so that you understand it and all that. That's it. It is so much part of people's lives that one of the most conservative medical organizations, or at least it was in the world, the British Medical Association, are the greatest champions of the National Health Service. Most of the research is done within the National Health Service. Why can't there be something like this? Not exactly the same. In fact, it could improve on it. The same. France has the same, Italy has the same, Holland has the same. What is it about US legislators that they appear to be so in bed with such powerful interests, such as the insurance companies, that they can't represent their own people's needs, their own people's basic human rights, and that's what it is. It's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, actually. It is a human right to have this kind of medical care. It's to take away fear. And all of us have experienced the fear of possible ill health. And I've interviewed so many people in the United States that I see them crippled both by what is medically wrong with them, but by this terrible insecurity that takes over their lives and the poverty then that consumes it as they try to pay for their medical care. It's primitive.
John Pilger, I want to ask you about Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, how you see, especially in Afghanistan, Pakistan, where President Obama says he's expanding the war. How you see it ending? You've done more than 50 documentaries, many of them mm-hmm. about wars around the world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also the response of the British people, how you see what's happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, Obama's begun a new war. There is an Obama war, and that's Pakistan. The shaking of the hornet's nest, if you like, in Pakistan, which this administration has done willfully, is an historic disaster. The creation of up to 2 million refugees in the northwest of Pakistan, caused by the attacks by the Pakistani government, egged on and paid for by the Obama administration. The use of electronic battlefield weapons, such as drones and other unmanned vehicles. Drones have killed, according to the Pakistani authorities, American drones launched from, I believe, near Las Vegas, have killed something like 700 civilians since the inauguration of President Obama. So there's a new war. It's It's a war in Pakistan. I believe there is a new jargon term in Washington called AFPAC, which is it's almost beyond commenting on. The Afghanistan war, so-called, is really about building, as Gates has said, Robert Gates, the defense secretary, has virtually admitted, is about building a number of secured permanent bases throughout that country and reinforcing the major facility at Bagram. The United States has no intention of getting out of Afghanistan. It is building one of its fortress embassies in Kabul, just as it's building a $1 billion embassy in Islamabad, just as it's built an enormous fortress in Baghdad. Whatever happens to American ground troops, who eventually, yes, will be withdrawn, will make no difference to the significance of the American presence, the violent American presence in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and in Iraq. These are seen as places where the United States will have a permanent presence to be able to, a strategic position, to where it'll be able to monitor and perhaps influence and perhaps control the influences of its imperial rivals. Bagram base is being extended. It probably has a worse record, if that's possible, than Guantanamo in terms of its human rights abuses. What we will see is, as Obama has said, we will see American ground troops gradually withdrawn. But as they're withdrawn, the use of electronic weaponry and bombing and will increase, unless there is an understanding of this in this country, unless people stop taking the pronouncements of governments at their word. When Obama went to Annapolis and said, we're getting out of Iraq, and appeared to be giving a timetable, within a matter of weeks, I believe, General Casey, the head of the army, contradicted him and said, oh, no, we'll probably be there for another 10 years. And other Pentagon generals put it even higher, 15 years. No mention is made of the enormous American army of mercenaries that who are in all those theaters of war and special forces. No mention is made of the special forces operation inside Iraq, inside Iran. $400 million was allotted to that particular secret war by Bush in one of his signing decrees, which money has gone to both the Kurdish and Baluchi separatist movements. The whole region is being crafted, if you like, for a very, very long American colonial presence, and eventually it will not need a standing army there. That's the future in that part of the world, as I say, unless people become aware of that and start to knock, bang on the doors of government, of Congress, and of power in this country, To expose it.
Award-winning filmmaker John Pilger. You can get a copy of the show at democracynow.org. And this late-breaking news, former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara died in his sleep this morning in Washington, D.C. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.